This time of year can be depressing for some people. The avalanche of snow over the last 9 days was perhaps an anomaly, but even without Snowmageddon, dark skies, short days, and cold temperatures can be gloomy. Plus, there's the 2016 presidential election and the resulting changes and reordered priorities in Washington, which have left religious liberals everywhere seriously disturbed. Some people I recently spoke with here in our congregation reported teetering on the edge of despair. It's partly the winter blues, and it's partly, I think, a collective response to the body politic of the body politic to the angry, hard-edged political atmosphere experienced by many as a body blow to their democratic faith. About a decade ago, a church member I was close to requested that I write and deliver a sermon on the right to die, and I did in the end. You know, we have this tradition, most of our congregations and here, of an auction. And in the auction, I typically offer a couple of things, one of which is a sermon of your choice if you make the highest bid. I'll preach on anything for the right amount of money. And so this fellow wanted me to preach on the right to die. Now, initially, I was a bit reluctant until I remembered reading an article years earlier by the writer and Whole Earth Catalog editor, Stuart Brand. Always pushing the envelope, Brand was about to publish an essay on how to commit suicide. But he, just like me, had had misgivings, and he decided to ask his minister, Richard Baker, then Roshi of the San Francisco Zen Center, what he thought of the idea. "Don't publish an article on how to commit suicide," said Baker Roshi. "Publish an article on how not to commit suicide." Hence this morning's sermon. And as it was back, I think it was 13 years ago, I gave this sermon, then I gave the, or not this one, but an earlier iteration of this, and then I gave the sermon on the right to die. Now, let's be honest. Suicide merits our attention. As an ever-present option, it is also scary. Whenever someone we've known succumbs to suicide, we are reminded of our vulnerability to its apparent allure. My dad committed suicide 2 weeks after I graduated from high school, the summer I turned 18. Others I have known and cared for have also committed suicide, including more than a few congregants over the years. In my last settled ministry, Santa Fe, the chair of our membership committee, a deeply loved and respected church member, took her life alone at home, despite the efforts of many of us who knew she was depressed and did all we could to keep her alive. I am still grieving 11 years later. Stuart Brand's original plan had been sparked by the Hemlock Society's efforts to promote death with dignity for the terminally ill. Now known as Compassion and Choices, Unitarian Universalists started many of its chapters around the country, including here in the Puget Sound area. Compassion and Choices members argue that suicide is acceptable under certain circumstances, such as incurable disease and old age. The idea is that although life is in general good, people who face irreversible suffering should not be forced to continue suffering. Most Unitarian Universalists would agree with this idea, or at least support the rights of those who do. By and large, liberal religion asserts that a person's life belongs to them only, and no other person has a right to force on others their own conviction that life must be lived. Only the individual involved can make that decision, and whatever decision that person makes, it should be respected. The late psychiatrist Thomas Szasz, once named Humanist of the Year by the American Humanist Association, went further, arguing that suicide is the most basic right of all. If freedom equals ownership over one's life and body, then the right to end that life is the most basic right of all. If others can force you to live, you do not own yourself, but belong to them. Indeed, philosophical thinking in the 19th and 20th centuries led, in some cases, to the point where that suicide was no longer a last resort or even something that one must justify, but something that one must justify not doing. Many forms of existentialist thinking essentially begin with the premise that life is objectively meaningless, and proceed to the question of why one should not go ahead and jump off the bridge. Most answer that situation by suggesting that the individual has the power to give personal meaning to life. The existentialists Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre, for instance, both rejected suicide, considering it to be an escape from freedom, fleeing in their minds into the absurdity, from the absurdity of reality into illusions, religion, or into death, was not, for either Camus or Sartre, the way out. We should embrace life passionately, both men believed, despite its meaninglessness, and despite its alarming, sometimes horrible violence. Philosophy notwithstanding, nearly everyone who contemplates suicide does so because they're severely depressed. In The Butcher's Wife, Taiwanese feminist writer Li Ang declares, "People commit suicide for one reason only, to escape torment." While I was living and serving as a Unitarian Universalist minister on Martha's Vineyard Island off the coast of Cape Cod, the award-winning author William Styron, living right across the street actually from the little UU church there, fell victim to a crippling and almost suicidal depression, the same illness, incidentally, that took the lives of Sylvia Plath, Prima Levi, and Virginia Woolf. Styron wrote about his descent in a memoir, Darkness Visible. He manages to convey its torturous progression and his eventual recovery with a heart-rending candor and precision that will arouse a shock of recognition even in people who have been spared the suffering Styron describes. Television actress and Los Angeles resident Mariette Hartley has also written powerfully about suicide and how to prevent it. When I was living in Venice Beach, I attended a lecture by Ms. Hartley at the Venice Public Library on how she overcame a family history of alcoholism and suicide. There were a lot of others attending with similar family histories. Mariette Hartley's down-to-earth presentation and the heartfelt discussion that ensued were powerful, healing experiences for me and for many others in attendance, I am sure. If you were one of those rare souls who've never known anyone who killed themselves, you might think that it is a rare occurrence and freaky. But it is not rare, just rarely talked about. As YouTube celebrity Logan Paul discovered last year when, in Japan's Aikagahara forest near Mount Fuji, he uploaded images of what appeared to be a body of a distraught man who had just hanged himself. Paul apparently thought he was pushing the envelope. He was surprised when his emotional cluelessness was universally and heartily condemned. In the United States currently, somebody takes their own life every 18 minutes. Suicide is much, much more common than homicide. Suicide is the highest cause of death among those 15 to 24 and among people over 65. Many of these deaths were probably preventable. Survivors often regret their decision immediately. Ken Baldwin and Kevin Hines are among the handful of people who have jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived. Baldwin was 28 and severely depressed on the August day in 1985 when he told his wife not to expect him home until late. As he leapt, Baldwin recalls, "I instantly realized that everything in my life that I'd thought was unfixable was totally fixable, except for having just jumped." Kevin Hines was 18 when he jumped off the bridge in September 2000. "I was like, screw this, nobody cares," he recalled, "so I jumped. But then my first thought was, what the hell did I just do? I don't want to die." There's a mixed up, totally confused quality to most suicidal thinking, including a sense of power that comes from having the last word. But do we? Buddhists and Hindus, believing in reincarnation, also believe that we carry our karma with us beyond the grave. While they do not consign suicides to hell or anything like it, they point out that according to their understanding, taking one's own life does not resolve any of a person's problems. That whatever is gnawing at one's soul will continue through many lifetimes, if necessary, until it's properly worked through and resolved. Meanwhile, here in this life, you actually have a support system all around you, if you avail yourself of it, that can help. Reach out to them. I often mention this to UUs who confide in me about their suicidal ideation. Despairing over the loss of a job or loved one or declining powers, overwrought souls just want to die and escape it all. Knowing they cannot blot out a certain page of their lives, they decide to throw the whole book into the fire. Okay, but if the Buddhists and Hindus are correct, all their issues will abide within their soul, whatever they do to their bodies. And they'll still have to deal with it all. Now, I'm not sure about life after death and reincarnation. I'm actually pretty agnostic on the subject. But I do know how I feel about church members who are contemplating suicide and do not talk to me about what's churning away inside their broken hearts. So please, if you are struggling with such matters as I am speaking to this morning, give me a call. Let's talk it over. And who knows? Maybe the Buddhists and Hindus are right. Maybe there is reincarnation. Impossible to know for sure, but if that's so, let me make one thing clear. If there is reincarnation, and you go ahead and kill yourself without letting me know what's going on first and talking to me about it, then get ready. Because come your next life, I'm going to find out who you are and where you're living, and I'm going to come kill you. So be forewarned. The other thing I always try to gently remind those contemplating taking their own life, and here I speak from experience, is what a terrible burn suicide is for those they leave behind. A wound that does not have to be, consider, Some suicides are carefully planned, but most are not. Few people wake up thinking they'll take their life, but circumstances suddenly make it possible. A couple of beers, an impulsive thought, and a gun can be an extremely volatile mixture. Berkeley suicidologist Dr. Richard Seiden published a study, Where Are They Now?, in which he followed up on 515 people who were prevented from jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge between 1937 and 1971. After, on average, more than 26 years, 94% of the would-be suicides were either still alive or had died of natural causes. The findings confirm previous observations that suicidal behavior is crisis-oriented and acute in nature, Seiden concluded. If you can get a suicidal person through his or her crisis, Seiden put the high-risk period at 90 days, chances are extremely good that they will not kill themselves later. 90 critical days, 3 months, 1 season. How to keep on keeping on for a quarter of the year. My 5-point plan. 1, reach out to people who care about you, starting with your family and your minister. 2, talk to your doctor. Medication can achieve a lot. Even mild sleeping pills are helpful, very helpful when it comes to making it through emotionally rough patches. 3, be careful about self-medication, alcohol and controlled substances, which only tend to add fuel to the fire. 4, very important, lock up any guns or other lethal methods. And 5, don't be afraid to talk about your situation. You are not alone. It's impossible to know whether any one suicide might have been prevented, but many suicidal people do, in fact, want to be saved. The eminent suicidologist E.S. Schneidman has said, "The paradigm is the man who cuts his throat and cries for help with the same breath." After thinking about this for the last 50 years, I've decided that what would-be suicides need is hope. The feeling we have, that the feeling we now have is not permanent, that things will change, that our pain, excruciating as it may be, will heal, and that better days will come. As the English author and poet Vida Sackville-West once put it, "To hope for paradise is to live in paradise, a very different thing than actually getting there." Just imagining a better day is the first step, the critical step to discovering it. But how to imagine and thereby mobilize hope? When dealing with superhuman powers, and depression for those who have suffered it is such a power, personifying them also often helps us to personify these powers, gives us some handle for attending to them. That's the benefit, one important benefit anyway, of mythology. Consider the Greek myth of Pandora's box. After Prometheus' theft of fire, or the secret actually of how to control fire, Zeus ordered Hephaestus to create the woman Pandora. She was given many seductive gifts from the Aphrodite, Hermes, Hera, and the other goddesses and gods. Fearing reprisals for his theft of fire, Prometheus warned his brother Epimetheus not to accept anything from Zeus. But Epimetheus became smitten and would not listen, and he married Pandora. Pandora had been given a large jar and instructions by Zeus to keep it closed. But having also been given the gift of curiosity, she ultimately broke down and opened the box. When she opened it, all of the evils, ills, diseases, and burdensome labor that humankind had not known previously escaped from the jar. Talk about cause for depression. But it is said that at the very bottom of her box, there lay one additional spirit, hope. As the poet says, hope springs eternal. One particular poet, Emily Dickinson, put it this way. Hope is a thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. Hope, it seems to me, is not so much a feeling as something you do, a modus operandi. The old universalists used to refer to their religion, our religion, as the larger hope. And they would sign letters, yours in the larger hope, the hope that all would be saved. For they believed ultimately all would be saved, and everything in life, everything across the whole universe would be redeemed, that the entire cosmos would, in the final disposition of things, be reabsorbed into the eternally loving creative principle at the source, at the center of reality. The old universalists did not stop there, by the way, just believing that their salvation was assured and wrapped up in everyone else's. No. Those universalists then organized their lives accordingly on the assumption that if the whole of reality was connected and was destined for joy and wonder and happiness, then they wanted to help it along. I still believe that, unequivocally. Others of you may be less sure. I myself am sometimes less sure. We all are. Which is why, then as now, gathering regularly with others who share a creative and optimistic view of life is crucial to staying healthy and strong. But one doesn't have to be an old-style theological universalist. Like Camus and Sartre, you may think the world is meaningless, or it may feel that way to you. Fine. But if that's how it feels to you, please go a step further and, like Camus and Sartre, embrace life in spite of its meaninglessness. You will find the absurdity funnier, the human touches sweeter, more poignant, and more beautiful, too. Be part of the larger hope. Like the poet Kabir proposed, clearly a small you universalist, make love with all you find beautiful and important and special in life before you. Music, art, nature, your grandchildren, working for justice, a good book, Marx Brothers movies, gardening, talking to old friends, whatever you love, hope is right there. And it will sustain you, if you let it, even through the darkest night. So let it in, and let it be. Shalom. Amen. And namaste.